You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, my kindreds, happy Christmas Eve. We are rolling into 2026 with all kind of stuff going on. So keep your head straight, your minds focused, and try to have a good time despite anything that may be troubling you or anyone else that you know in our personal lives. Right now, we just have to trust and have faith that things are moving in the direction that they should be, because our species as humanity, we don't know what we're doing. We don't know. So let's just say that we don't know. Let's be honest with everybody. Say we don't know what we're doing. We're having to have some kind of intervention because we have free will, and with free will comes human egos, people that are distorted minds, people that think they know that don't know, people that are trained, they're not trained. I mean, it's just so many different mixtures of humanity going on. So I am really happy that Mother Nature and the spiritual entities out there that protect the planets and the universe are in place. So thank you. So today, shout out to the Africa Channel, africachannel.com. And before we get into our guest today, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor. Yay, hey, Kevin Pike, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist, COA Banker, 818-571-1508. Again, Kevin Pike, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist, COA Banker, 818-571-1508. Hey, so our guest today is a very special person in my life. Number one, I'm close to him as a part of my family, and so I love him dearly. But on the other hand, he is one of those badasses in the professional world. Dr. Tucker Pack is a prominent clinical psychologist. He is a respected meditation teacher, an author known for bridging the gap between Western spirituality, psychology, and traditional Buddhist meditation. He is particularly recognized for the pragmatic Dharma. He handles spirituality in a very practical way. And so that's why everybody is such a turner. He's also the author of a book we're going to talk about today called Sanity and Sainthood. So let's welcome our guest, Dr. Tucker Pack. Hey, Tucker.
Hi, that was a great intro. I've had done a bunch of interviews. Nobody's ever called me badass in the intro before. Thank you.
Well, you are badass. You are a psychologist, psychotherapist, author, practitioner of meditation, and a Dharma expert. So I want to get right into it.
That's good.
And you just became an author. I mean, your book says it came out 2025, Sanity and I forget the other part of it.
Sainthood.
I want to say sisterhood. That's where I'm stuck in my mind. And I have
anybody read a book by a man called Sisterhood?
In my mind, it keeps wanting to go to sisterhood, but it says sainthood because a lot of sisterhood things are going on right now. So, Sanity and Sainthood by Dr. Tucker Pack. So let's get right into it. Hey, so how you doing today?
Oh, gee, pretty good. My baby has something called hand, foot, and mouth disease, but so far I do not have hand, foot, and mouth disease, so nothing to complain about.
I'm always having hand, foot, and mouth disease. Because I'm an honest person, I'll say what's on my mind versus trying to do what other people do and fake to hurt. I'm too old, number one, to be doing all of that. So I figure the people that love me and know me can handle the truth. We're supposed to be adults. That's what I was told anyway. So let's get into why this particular title. Why Sanity and Sainthood?
Yeah, so where the title comes from is, so I live in Alameda near San Francisco, and a lot of the people that I work with, so I'm a psychologist, I'm a therapist, I have a private practice, and then I travel around teaching residential meditation retreats. So this is going to be places where regular people with families and jobs will live like monks and nuns for a period of time. So you take a vow of celibacy, a vow of silence. The shortest ones I do are 3 days. The longest ones I do with a big group are 17 days. So it can be pretty long. Mm-hmm. And the because I think I'm based in San Francisco area, a lot of the people coming to my clinic, a lot of the people coming on retreats, are people doing pretty well, at least financially. You know, there's a lot of techies in this area. And the idea a lot of people are coming into my retreats and my clinic with is their lives are going really well. They don't feel all that good. And if they meditate for a little while, they will become enlightened. And that means that you feel great. And unfortunately, that's not true.
Yeah.
Sainthood are what I think of as the goals of what happens if your psychotherapy and your meditation practice is going really well. Sanity means you are responding to your life appropriately. What I mean by that is, like, if you have a pretty good life, you should feel pretty happy most of the time. And if your grandma just died, you should feel sad. Whereas, you know, you meet people who are numb enough that their grandma dies and they feel nothing. And I meet a lot of people whose lives are going absolutely fine and they feel terrible a lot of the time. So one actual goal you get from this work is sanity. Sainthood is, you know, a tall order. But I think of both sanity and sainthood as things to move towards, you know, not things to get. The reason I think of sainthood as the goal of meditation is I do think there are a few bad people out there. I've met a few, you probably met a few, but people who just don't care about the rights of others and don't care if they're hurting people. But I don't think there's a lot. I travel all over the world. Almost everybody I meet wants to be a good person. I want to be a good person. I know you want to be a good person. Can I swear on the show?
No, you're fine.
Is it okay if I swear on the show?
You can do whatever you want to do on the show if you're in.
Yeah, so I want to be a good person, and I fuck it up every day. Why do I want to do this and I'm unable to? There's all sorts of things going on in my mind that I can't see. Mm-hmm. And the effect of meditation, one effect of meditation, is you actually see more and more and more what's happening in your unconscious mind. And when you see it, you control it. It doesn't control you. Mm-hmm. So both in, you know, modern America and historically throughout the world, there's so many stories of these supposedly advanced spiritual teachers or pastors who turn out to be terrible people, failing morally, not at the level that normal people fail at, but failing at way higher levels than normal people fail at. And one other idea of sanity is I wanted to call bullshit on that. If your spiritual practice is working, you should be able to see your intentions clearly, and you should be able to act better and better. Of course, everybody makes mistakes, but doing the same wrong thing that you know is wrong over and over and over, spiritual practice should stop that. So this is the idea of sanity and sainthood. You don't get to feel the way you want to feel all the time. But as you continue looking at your mind, you should become saner and you should become a better person.
Right. So let me ask you, let me say something. You are basically known as the humorous, pragmatic dharma psychologist, psychotherapist. You work a lot with people with PTSD, anxiety, mental disorders, I'm assuming to some degree, and all of those sorts of things because you are trained. How much of these issues are a part of the person's mental landscape? Not necessarily anything coming from the outside, but their own mental landscape from wherever they stand. They may be educated, not educated. They may have gone through hard times, not hard times. So how much of that plays into our own psyche that we create all of these delusions for ourselves?
Whoa. Hard question for the first 5 minutes of the show. let me see what I can get at there.
Be yourself. Just say what you want to say.
So, like, Certainly these things are real. So to say delusion, it doesn't mean that there's some easy fix, right? So I think a lot of people have had this situation where something's wrong and you go see the doctor and the doctor says, oh, your tests are normal, so it's psychological. And you're like, well, what the hell does that mean? It's like, oh, well, it means you should just decide to stop having these symptoms and stop wasting my time. Goodbye. So when we talk about delusion, certainly I don't mean like anxiety, PTSD, depression, the kind of symptoms you're listing. Certainly I don't mean like they're easy or there's a choice you can make or something like that. I guess sometimes I would see these as residing inside a person, meaning there's somebody who is traumatized, somebody who is anxious, and you put them into a big happy family on Christmas dinner, and you put them on the beach in Hawaii, and they're just as traumatized and just as anxious as they were anyplace else, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can say, yeah, this trouble seems to reside in the individual's mind. And then other times, you actually see the issue is residing like between people and society, where maybe the way I see this most commonly, there was this great kind of famous podcast episode maybe 15 years ago. It was a psychologist who had gone to Rwanda following the genocide there. And I can't remember the man's name. The story that he tells is he's going there to do psychotherapy with the genocide survivors. And at some point, the community says, hey, you want us to sit in a dark room and talk about bad things that happened to us. We have a better idea. We'd like to show you our version of therapy. And they get the whole community together, and they're singing and dancing, and they have the psychologist stripped naked, and they throw animal blood on him. And he said it basically cured him more than he was curing anybody else. And one big aspect of this is, for many of us here in America, community isn't a thing anymore. Community is almost impossible to find. Community and freedom are the opposite, right? Freedom means you do whatever you want to do. Community means you adjust your behavior to fit in with the group. If you do whatever you want to do, you're going to be all alone pretty soon, right? Mm-hmm. And so my little pet theory is the reason that so many of these emotions get stuck within our minds is that in the West in general, but in America, way worse than any place else, many of us just don't have communities. In many places here, you can get married, and I'm married. It's awesome. I'm really glad I'm married. My husband is possibly listening to this show, so I have to be careful. but it's really hard to do more than that. And I think that big emotions like big traumas and terrifying things, these emotions are supposed to be processed in community. I was saying our baby's sick, and the way we get him to sleep is we get the whole family in the room. He needs like everybody around rocking him and petting him. And he's sick. He's in a lot of pain. But if we're all there, he's okay. And he falls asleep. So I do think sometimes these things are within us. I think sometimes these things get stuck within us because we don't have communities to share the emotions with. And then certainly sometimes the emotions can be between us, meaning, oh, you meet somebody who is depressed and you're trying to figure out why they're depressed and they're telling you all sorts of terrible things and they don't seem to be getting better. And so you invite their spouse into the session and their spouse keeps nagging them. And the more that their spouse nags them, the more that the client sort of shuts down and gets quiet. And basically it's a problem in the marriage. The nagging causes the other person to emulate depression, to shut down and go dead to stop the nagging. And that's the sort of person where if you send them to a Christmas Eve dinner with a different family or put them on the beach in Hawaii, they might actually be kind of fine. That the disorder lies not within their own mind, but in their situation. I could say more about that, but over to you.
Which brings me to another side of the question. So then let's just do this. So on social media, as an example, you have all of these things coming at you at the same time. You got this information coming there. You got that information. You have to determine what information you want to filter through, what information you want to allow in your mind. How much of the bullshit that society feeds us do we breathe in, absorb it, and then when we meditate, how, I know what happens to me, but I want to know, in most of your situations, then how does meditation come in and then calm, oh, I'm Black, or I'm white, or I'm a Mexican, or I'm rich, or I'm poor, or whatever the differences that we make amongst each other, how much of those things can we then calm or even get rid of when we meditate and they're still out there affecting us? How do we
I think that there's basically three core impulses in the human psyche.
Yes.
Don't die, have sex, and don't upset the tribe. That third one, I think, doesn't get as much airplay. Mm-hmm. And all of these can be hacked by nefarious forces, right? So don't die makes it easy to make people scared. Have sex, of course, from the moment there's been advertising. Advertisers have been hacking. Humans want to, creatures want to reproduce. And if you show us pretty creatures, we'll buy your product. The main way we're being hacked through social media is through don't upset the tribe. In America, like I was saying, we don't really have tribes anymore. Particularly in places where people aren't religious. Certainly, there are some real pros and cons to organized religion, but one of the pros of organized religion is you get a tribe. Particularly in the places where we don't really have much organized religion, we don't have tribes. And social media, or some nefarious actors use social media to hack this, to say, hey, Osiris, you're Black, and Black people like this product. And they hold this political view. And then, of course, our social media friends, they're like us, right? So then you get social media friends who say, oh, you're liberal, you're Californian, right? You're rich, you're poor, you're like us. And we believe these things. And it turns out to be really easy to trick communities into believing stuff because that desire to fit in with the tribe is about as strong as the desire not to die. How does meditation help with this? Through social media and nefarious factors and non-nefarious factors, we absorb a lot of bullshit all day. And one thing you see from that bullshit is your body starts tightening off. If you picture the place where you are loving, trusting, whatever the next person who shows up, whatever political team they're on, whatever they look like, wherever they come from, you're just like trusting and you meet them openly. Your body feels pretty relaxed. It kind of literally feels open. If the next person who shows up is scary, if they don't think like you, if they don't look like you, if they're in a different Twitter circle than you're in, your body feels tight, right? So one of the first things you notice within a few minutes of meditation is you're actually holding your body tight. Holding your body tight out of, you know, fear. If you were actually threatened, if somebody might be ready to hurt you, what you would do is tense your whole body, right? And what happens in the animal kingdom is you're a squirrel. You see a coyote. Your whole body gets tense. And then you either, I guess the squirrel probably wouldn't fight the coyote, but the squirrel would run. Other animals might fight. Basically, you feel threatened, and then you get a lot of exercise immediately, and this turns off the sense of feeling threatened. Mm-hmm. We humans take on this sense of threat. There's other people out there. They're the wrong team. They're coming for you. And we just hold it. So in meditation, you feel your body. The Buddha says the first foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the body in the body. The first thing you should learn is how to feel your body. And you feel your body and you notice your chest is pretty constricted. It's actually pretty hard to breathe. And you may not be able to immediately relax it in the first 2, 3, 4 weeks, maybe even months of meditation. You may not be able to relax it. Over time, you'll get good both at noticing how you're feeling stuff in your body and at releasing that stuff from your body. And there is one sense in which this releases a lot of the tribalism. This is why it's a path towards sainthood. All the like fear of other people, fear of society, fear of people, you let go of this, right? Certainly some of that fear is justified. There are people out there who want to hurt you, but a lot of them, almost everybody I meet seems like they're a good person and trying to be a good person. The other thing I wanted to say though, so I grew up seeing myself as white. I think I probably pretty mistakenly thought that other people saw me as white. And as actually a function of doing lots of meditation, I started feeling Jewish. And I don't think I've been to a... And I am, sorry. It's not like if you meditate, you pick some new religion.
No, I just think it's funny. You said, wait a minute, am I something else too? Or, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, I think... I don't think I've walked in a synagogue in 20 years or something. It's not that I practice it, but I was talking to one of my mentors when this started happening, and I was like, you know, I look into my psyche, and I sort of feel like it's a Jewish psyche. And this mentor is a light-skinned Egyptian guy, and he said, yeah, you know, people also, they often think I'm white, and I just thought I was white, and I did all this looking inside, and I'm Egyptian. I don't think that looking inside leads to a kind of like you just join the tribe of humanity. But what I think it does is like, yeah, you inherit psychological stuff from your ancestors, and all of our ancestors were in tribes, right? Your parents, my grandparents, tribe is the first thing they would have said, right? My grandma would have said, oh, Osiris, a wonderful black woman, right? Tribe is the first thing she would have said. And I bet that's the first thing your parents would have said, that we've always been in tribes. Now, psychologically, many of us are kind of not in tribes. And I do feel that in my psyche as I meditate, that like, there's not the tribalism. I'm not as easy to hack, but I'm not just kind of a pure blank slate of humanity.
So do you think that, now I'll say personally, I started meditating in 19, let's see, after I got out of the military, it'll have been 1973, Northern California, and California is full of all kinds of options. So when you come to California, whatever you are, you can be anything you want. There's not a lot of strict underlying what you can be or how much you explore.
Yeah.
So when I got out of the military, I met Dr. Robert Kimball. I met the Rosicrucians. I met Nikki Michaels from the Aurora Institute. And when I got to LA, I got a degree from University of Metaphysics, Dr. Paul Masters, who now is in Arizona. So I had all of these things inside of me anyway, but I was the only black person or person of, you know, interest that was interested in these sort of things. So when I started doing those things, I met all of these group of people. None of them were black. They were all white from everywhere. One of the women was from Poland. Somebody else was from Russia. So I was, and being a person that's empathic, and a person that experiences a lot of different things at one time, even in a room, just a flush of all these sensations and things going on inside and on the outside to other people, you're looking normal. Like, oh, there's not, you know, it's just a face with a voice. On the inside of someone like me, there's all these things going on, all these triggers, all of this and then this pull, that pull. And Swami Muktananda taught us how to meditate. He was an invited guest. at Nikki's class or one of the classes she had or some group or something, because it's way back early, you guys. I was like in my 19, I'm like way over 60 now. So I'm trying to memorize as best I can. So Nikki, if you are listening to me, hi, baby. And number two, you know, so if I'm not quite, my memory is not quite as sharp because it has been a little long time and I was a young woman then, younger girl. So, but they taught us, first of all, to just relax. He didn't, you know, they were from the Eastern philosophy, so they didn't really go into some, oh, it's a structured thing, just relax. He did something like with his hands. And then the next thing we knew, we were like, what? And I, you know, I'm like, okay, I've only experienced the Black church. I have no idea what these people are doing, you know. And so I'm just, in my mind, I'm going, what the hell is going, you know, because I'm, you know, I'm into things that I'm trying to learn and I'm trying to not trying, but wanting to let go of some aspect of my culture and embrace new things. So for you, when you became a meditator and then eventually became a meditation instructor or teacher, however you want to do it, what was the first thing that happened to you when you took that breath? You know how they tell you, okay, now breathe, deep breathing inside, release, and then breathe again. Well, Muktananda didn't do that. He was just, he sat in sati, you know, he sat in a meditative form with his body. So we got to really experience some other different things. What was it like for you? And where did you start and how did you get in? What made you want to do meditation?
Yeah, I got, when I was 19, I got mono really bad. I was sick for 6 months. And so I couldn't really do anything. And so I started reading about meditation thinking, well, if I'm just sitting around, maybe I could sit around better. And I was on the beach and I was meditating. I grew up in Florida and I suddenly felt like there was no difference between me and the chair I was sitting in and the sand and the water. It mm-hmm. was all one thing. And I drove home at like half the speed limit because I was just like, nowhere to go, nothing to do. And for about a week, I tried to live in line with what I had seen. And I had what, in retrospect, feels like a strangely mature insight, which was I thought, oh, living this way and being 19, these things are at odds with each other. I'm going to be 19, and I will pick this up later.
Okay.
So I just dropped it. And then I used to... if I had free time, I would drive as far as it was possible to drive in that free time. So I had a Christmas break from college. I drove 10,000 miles in 3.5 weeks. And when I was 22, I had driven from Providence, Rhode Island, up through Canada, up into like Jasper, down to Portland, Oregon. And I was in Oregon lying in the grass, just like feeling the sun on my body. And it was pretty nice. And I was like, gee, it's weird that I had to drive 6,000 miles to lie in the grass. We have grass where I started. And back when I was 19, I had read this line by Thich Nhat Hanh, which said, we do not need to go to China to enjoy the blue sky. So I thought, I have to learn to enjoy the blue sky without going to China. And actually the following year, I did go to China, but it was just as a tourist. It was, and also like, there's no blue sky in China. It's the air is very polluted. So, so I ran over to Powell's bookstore and I read Thich Nhat Hanh books all day. And then when I got back home, I joined a Thich Nhat Hanh Sangha. So now we're getting to like my first meditation at a meditation group. And, you know, sit and relax and see if you can feel your breathing. And I could not stop my hands from moving. And I thought, oh, this is why I need to meditate. I need to stop fidgeting. And for those of you watching this on video, I've been fidgeting with a guitar capo the entire time the show has been going. I haven't stopped fidgeting, but in whatever it's been almost 25 years of meditating, I can tell you every micro anxiety behind each fidget with the guitar capo. I'm still like a very high energy person that hasn't changed, but I can see what's going on in my mind so much more clearly.
You are, wow, you're special too. See, a lot of people, what I've discovered in doing what my stuff has been and then wanting to talk to you more about it, is that there are, number one, like Western society. I stopped listening to Western society once I got out of high school. It's just nothing in the environment made sense to me. Like, this is stupid, you know? You want to teach people this kind of stuff? It's stupid. It doesn't even make common sense. So I am led. I actually have a leading. Something led me to here. Something led me to move to California. My whole life, and you feel the same way, I feel compelled to do things. The things I'm doing, I'm compelled to do them. I've been thinking of them my whole life. When I was a child, I was viewed as crazy and out of pocket, and you don't fit this community, don't do that. So I stopped trying to fit in. I don't care to fit in anymore. I don't mind that I'm unique and I'm different. And I'm not the conventional person that falls along with every conventional thing. I've never been that. And the people that have come around me, as you yourself probably have experienced, either can vibe with me at this level, because I am high level energy and so are you, or they got to move away. My energy is too high for you. So go and be slow, or whatever your five senses. I'm operating on more than six senses, you know. And then when I got into reading and all of that, it opened my mind even more. I started doing even more studying. Madame H. Blavatsky and Manly B. Hall and Napoleon Hill, and all these astrologers and, you know, hermetics and, you know, vegetarians and all of those. People in my community that I had never heard of. So you have to understand that when you go back to your own community, I don't say tribe. I think it's an insult to Native Americans and to African people. Not that you mean it insulting, but I don't use it because I've never put on a costume. I don't know what it's like to be in a tribe, to go and put on a costume. We go out and do a ritual and we're all going in and in and out, or we're all, you know, like the African people that they're all colored up and they're ornamented. I don't know what that is. So I don't say the word tribe. I think it's America's way of trying to make up what they've done to the Native Americans, to the people of this country. Trying to, oh, well, since we fucked up, let's just bring everybody together, make it a tribe. Everybody's not going to come together like that. Some people are still angry that you fucked up. Some people are still upset that it's fucked up. And I don't know if they'll ever get over it, but you and I have grown past it. So when you are working with people that are in a meditative state, how much of their individuality, along with their community structures, their ancestors, do we get to leave behind while we go into those levels and stages of the mind that we are meditative? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Thanks. So I tend to think of three, like, levels, three types of reality. There's sort of regular reality. I've recently been calling it uncle space, because you can call your uncle and talk to him about this, right? So there's regular reality, which is the thing you can tell your uncle about. There's this really diverse, like, group of spaces that I would call shamanic reality. And shamanic reality is things you can't talk to your uncle about. It's too weird. And there's lots and lots and lots of types of these sort of altered realities. And the thing that's different about shamanic reality versus default world is default world doesn't really care how you're feeling. As in, like, if you like me or dislike me, or you're having a good day or having a bad day, I look exactly the same. Mm-hmm. If you are taking psychedelics, if you are in deep meditation, if you are doing a vision quest, if you're doing something to enter shamanic reality, in any of these altered senses of reality, how you're feeling actually is a big determinant of what reality looks like. If you're scared, reality quite literally looks scared, looks scary. There are some realms where you see disincarnate beings. And yeah. I I don't know whether they're real. Actually, I don't even know what the word real means when we get into that level. But if you are happy, you see, you know, angels or Buddhas or deities or something. And if you're scared, you see ghosts. So there's this really wide variety of shamanic realities. And you do see ancestors in there. You know, the thing where you start identifying with your people, with where you came from. You like meet your ancestors and they sure identified with their people and where they came from. Mm-hmm. There's this third level of reality. It's sometimes called ultimate. It's sometimes called non-dual. It's sometimes called the ineffable because it's hard to talk about. I think it's what Aldous Huxley called the perennial philosophy. It's probably what mystics mean when they say God. It's like there's only one thing. The whole universe is just one thing. You are that thing. You're not separate from that thing. And that thing is immortal and immutable. It can't die. It can't change. And all of the things that happen in the world don't touch it. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the metaphor that it's like the water versus the waves, that there's all sorts of things going on with waves and currents and whirlpools. And you could look at it that way. And there's another way of looking at it where it's just all water and there's the same amount of water and none of that changes. Your question was something about like bringing ancestry. How does that relate to meditation? And I think it depends on where you go. There are realms where it at least feels like you are talking to ancestors. None of my ancestors have ever told me the winning lottery numbers. You know, the question of can I prove that I'm really talking to dead people versus this is an experience my unconscious mind is projecting? I don't know. No way to tell. But yeah, sometimes you see them and then sometimes you go to a place where the idea of birth and death doesn't make any sense because nothing can change.
Yeah, I remember that is a good analogy. And you're absolutely correct about there are parts of the mind that there are certain filters in them. I may not be as psychologically adequate to express that, what I'm trying to say, but there are certain levels of the mind that have to be filtered through. Let me back it up, you guys. In the military, I found out about drugs, and they were good drugs, honey. We had chocolate mescaline hash. You know, the brothers would go over to the overseas in Greece and all those areas, pack all of the stuff in a back of the music speakers, and then they would all get shipped over to the U.S. So by the time I'm in the Navy, by the time we got on the ship, they would spread all the stuff. One of the guys, it's in my book, he taught a monkey how to roll joints. And so I thought, I was just like mesmerized by what, depending on what kind of drugs you do, where your mental state is when you do the drugs and why you're doing the drugs. So I wanted to fuck with my head. I'm like, I want to see what you're talking about. I want to know what it feels like to go into them deeper levels and all of that. So I induced my psychotic behavior with drugs. I did. I used acid a lot. No cocaine and things that are destroy you necessarily. And acid will certainly do that. But they react differently on the brain. They open the, you know, they open the mind up to these different spheres. And so I was often left alone or in a room that I felt safe, you know, with other people, but often kind of in my own world because I'm a little black girl with all these people from other cultures and all that teaching me all these things that I had to then come back and try to relay to what community. They didn't like me. People don't like me now because I'm different, you know, and who are you supposed to be? Well, darling, if you've had my life, maybe you would know the answer to that question. But the thing psychologically that happens in meditation, and then when I started chanting in the 27 or something, in 1981, I started chanting, and all of the things that I had done before prior to that had not given me one thing that I could see in my environment visibly, not one. I seemed crazy, unfocused to other people, but I'm trying to process being intuitive, listening to my own inner energy, trying to get other people's, what they're doing, and trying to hold space for all of that. So at that time, and I'm much older than you, Tucker. So at that time, they didn't have Tuckers and they didn't have all these people. I just had the group of people that introduced me to all of these things. Some of them were shamans. Some of them were, people that practiced. Now they were going under different names like Catherine Ponder and Manly Hall. And all of these people are Theosophians, and those are the people that I attracted. Those people, the astrologers, the mystic people and all of that. I never pulled in the conventional things because I don't fit the convention. And so when I started meditating and chanting, it brought on a whole nother level of energy that I want to ask you, because you've done a bit of chanting, when you do the chanting and the meditation, you said in your book that you have your classes or your meditation sessions do like 10 minutes of chanting or something, or you involve chanting or something in there. I want to know how that affects you. What happened to you when you started putting that together?
Yeah, well, you know way more about chanting than I do. I haven't done nearly as much as you have. What it does for me is it stops the voice in my head that, for most people, if you look inside, what you get is this idiotic rambling, this voice that says the same thing over and over, that's worried, that's planning for the future, that's thinking about food and sex, that's wondering whether anybody likes you. It doesn't seem to notice that it's saying the same thing over and over and over. You don't seem to notice it's saying the same thing. And so this is like the first challenge to introspection, is trying to get something other than the voice. And the voice is really sneaky. So the story of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, it's my favorite. It's my favorite spiritual story. I tell it every retreat. So the Buddha has been, a spiritual wanderer for a while. And he says, I am going to sit under this tree until I either become enlightened or I die. And Mara is like one of the two Satan characters in the Buddhist literature. And so Mara is trying to stop the Buddha from getting enlightened. And Mara sends hailstorms and poisonous snakes and hordes of wild animals. Mara has his daughters do like a striptease for the Buddha. And when all of this fails, he says, you're just a kid. You think you're going to become enlightened? You arrogant bastard. Who do you think you are? And the Buddha touches the ground and it shakes in testament to all the good karma he's accrued, and he becomes the Buddha. When I'm teaching here, I always tell people, look, we're in a subduction zone. If you need to know whether you have good karma, just have faith. Don't try to cause an earthquake. The reason I like this story so much is a couple things. One is like, this is what the voice does, right? So the story, it's not a metaphor. It's a pretty literal description of what happens when you try to look inside. There's fear of snakes. And if you're scared of snakes, there's just snakes and snakes and snakes. And if the snakes don't get you, the naked people show up. And another thing I love about the story is the most powerful weapon the devil has in his arsenal isn't fear and death and lust and pain. It's just whispering in your ear, have you ever considered the possibility that you might be a terrible person? This is the last trick. This is the last trick that Mara uses. Have you ever considered the possibility that you suck? And so when you're listening to this voice in your head, it's really sneaky. Sometimes the voice will start talking about meditation. Wow, I'm really focusing internally right now. I've really got this. But of course, you're just listening to this stupid voice. So the thing that I like about chanting is it shuts the voice off. So when I teach my classes, we usually stay in silence, but sometimes we'll start with 10 minutes of chanting and then we go into silence. And then instead of having to like practice ignoring the voice saying this thing, ignoring it saying this thing, then the voice starts talking about how you're trying to ignore the voice and what a good job you're doing ignoring it and how you're supposed to not try it. And the voice just gets quiet. quiet from chanting, and like there's much more clarity inside.
I love that. So Tucker, in your book, it starts off, you in the introduction, you talk about Dharma, and then you talk about how, you know, just because we meditate and chant and all that doesn't mean that we're going to be like running around, oh, everything is bliss and I don't have any problems, things like that. It often, from what I discovered of being a person that does work in spiritual practices, it often is hellish.
Yes.
There's a lot of misery and suffering that goes along with trying to walk the spiritual path. You become inner lighted and all that. People hate you. What the hell? You know, you're doing smiling and grinning and got all the, you know, it's just, it is a, it's like a blessing and a curse simultaneously. And I want you to answer or tell me what you think. Do you think that humans really understand spirituality or what it takes to live a spiritual life? Because you get a lot of benefits and fortune, but it is not an easy life to live. And I can see why people don't want to do it. I can see why people would rather take the dark side, because it seems easy and fun until you get in there and all the promises that they promise you don't come true. But at the same time, do you think we're mixed up with naivety, sin, and religion, and that's why we can't seem to move forward as a society? Or what do you think about that?
So the reason that I wrote a book was that I kept meeting people who think what the argument you were attacking there, people who think this is easy and this feels good. What actually happens is small amounts of meditation, small amounts of spiritual practice, this does feel good. There's this kind of beginner's luck where if you're on week 3 of meditation, or sometimes it can go for a while, you're on month 9 of meditation, it feels amazing. I sometimes talk about suffering in this phase as just meditation deficit disorder. You know, some people aren't happy, but it's just because they don't do meditation. And conveniently, here I am, compassionate enough to teach them how to do it. That's a very like immature beginner phase, right? What happens as you meditate more is you start seeing how your mind works. And, you know, I work with a lot of military veterans and people who've had really, really challenging experiences in lives or challenging lives. I also work with quite a lot of like people who grew up in safe, rich families and have good, stable jobs, and people who've had pretty easy lives. And the people who've had the easiest lives can just cry every meditation retreat the whole time for a decade. There's so much screwed upness in everybody's psychology. And so this is one of the things I think you're referring to that makes it so hard is there's, I don't remember where this adage comes from, but the adage of the spiritual path is it's better not to start, but once you start, it's better to finish. I do believe that. Like, the reason most people do intense spiritual practice is that they are too crazy not to. That's certainly why I did it. And you are taking the red pill. You are seeing clearly, more and more clearly, what's going on in your mind. A lot of what's going on in your mind is awful. The basic theme of my book is because I teach meditation, my main psychotherapy job has been, my main specialty has been doing psychotherapy with people who do lots of meditation. And they are, in a sense, much easier to work with. They can see everything that's going on in their minds. You ask the average person, what are you feeling? And they don't know how to answer that. Right? Meditators know what they're feeling. You practice seeing it as just a thing that's happening, not a thing you're doing. So you can have a really ugly thought, a really gross feeling, and it's okay to share it. But meditators are in therapy longer than my non-meditators. They can see how messed up things are. And that's the route to fixing it, right? If you think spiritual practice is about feeling good, you're going to be very disappointed, and you're going to feel either like it doesn't work or you don't know how to do it. If you think spiritual practice is about seeing your mind clearly, seeing how fucked up your mind is, and then being able to work on how fucked up your mind is, that's the way that psychotherapy and spiritual practice intersect. And that's like a really healthy path towards towards sanity and towards sainthood.
That's a wonderful explanation. You did a great job. Because I know people ask that, well, yeah, I want to do good, Miss Osiris, but every time I try to do good, my family, they don't believe in what I'm doing, you know, or I can't find any support within my own household or my own community or my own, you know, friendship or whatever.
Yeah,
Most of my friends don't even understand who I am. They think they do. Because they only see a certain aspect of me, but they don't know what I do on a deeper level. Very few people, a couple of my close friends who are have their minds in this sort of direction, understand. But most people don't know what I do. They just see me as, you know, like, oh, that's just as a personality. But they don't understand the kind of works involved, you know, like you. They don't understand the kind of work that is involved. I don't know why that came up there, you guys. I must have touched some accidentally. Sorry. They don't know why that information or why they behave in certain ways. So we're getting close to time. We got to go. I want you to let us know where we can get your book. And I want you to ask the last question I'm going to ask you. Where can we get your book? Where are you on social media, if at all? And when are you going to be in the LA area or somewhere where people can go see you, do your thing? I know you travel globally to do these things, and we appreciate you for that.
So. Oh, yeah. Thank you. You can find me. My website's meditatewithtucker.com. If you Google Tucker Peck, or actually if you just Google Tucker and meditation, you'll get my website. That shows you where I'm going to be. I don't have any LA plans in the near future, but when I do, Suzanne will be the first person I tell, and you will be the second, so you can let everybody know when I will be down there. I teach a class every Monday at the San Francisco Dharma Collective. It's in the Mission in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. My one professional social account is on Twitter. I'm Tucker something Peck. It's a dash or a dot or an underscore, or I'm not too hard to find on Twitter. You don't want to follow me on Facebook and stuff. It's going to be, you know, sort of pictures of beach vacations and my kids and stuff. Mm-hmm. The book you can find at any online bookstore. You can get it at Amazon. If you want to buy it direct from the distributor so you don't give some of your money to Bezos, it's bit.ly, bit.ly /sanity and sainthood. And you got to make the S's capital or it won't work. Bit.ly /sanity and sainthood. With capital S's is a way to not have to pay the folks at.
So bit.ly at sanity and sainthood.
Bit.ly /sanity and sainthood with capital S's.
Okay, great. With capital S's only, just remember that. If you out there really into this kind of thing, I am. I'm totally interested in this stuff. So, you know, I bring people on here. It's for me too. I'm getting, you know, information and growing and glowing and all of that. Now,
while I'm listening, if I could just pitch one more project. Maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I started a charity. It's called the Open Dharma Foundation. Meditation retreats are expensive. Even the cheap ones, you have to pay for lodging and food and transportation. You have to pay the teacher. The Open Dharma Foundation at opendharmafoundation.org, it will pay for you to go on retreats if you cannot afford to go. If you want to learn the stuff and money is the obstacle, opendharmafoundation.org. And if you have some money and want to help people access spiritual practice, please, we're always accepting donations.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you. That's a good heart to have. So before we go, how would you suggest someone start to meditate?
In terms of the easiest practice, I do like the breath as a way of getting started. It's really straightforward. You will know whether you're focused on the breath or not focused on the breath. And so in Buddhism, they talk about the three jewels. The three jewels are what you need for your practice. It's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the example. It's the teacher, the pastor, the priest, whoever it is, the person who has done more of this than you have and can show you how to do it. The Dharma is the teachings. And the most important of three is the Sangha. The Sangha is the community. if you're in LA, if you're in a big city, there's often lots of groups you can join. If in-person groups are better, that's how I would get started. Find an in-person group and start going there. If you live someplace where there aren't in-person groups, there are millions of online groups.
You can also listen to Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. Stevie was talking about transcendental meditation way early before most of the Black community even knew what TD was, you know, TM was. Nobody had ever heard of the concept. Now here I am in the back, you know, I didn't even, and so when I went out there in my own community talking about all these things, they looked at me like, okay, she has lost, there's been way too many white folk and has lost her mind, including my own immediate family said that to me. But I'm glad I kept going. But before we go, again, I want to thank you profusely from the bottom of my heart and thank Little Sis Yi for connecting us and making it possible for me to have your contact information to come onto the show, because I know you're really busy, busy, busy. And for me, just look me up under Osiris underscore Munir underscore the painter on IG. You can do, look this on Facebook. I'm everywhere, all over the place, all at once, all at the same time, because that's just who I am. I can do all of that, be all those places. So do that. And then I want to thank all of you. I love you. I love you for who you are. You show up. You support the show. Without you, I could not do it. We cannot do it without each other. At some point, we all have to find some kind of commonality to support each other. So I really appreciate that. And I like you for being, you know, yourself and brave and not fearful of other people judging you. Just stay true to self. I remember my mother and my grandmother used to say, to thine own self be true. To thine own self be true. So if you can't be true to yourself, I don't know what you're doing out there. And then again, really, we want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Don't forget to smile. Thank Sam Hassan for allowing us to come into the studio today and helping us out on this rainy, stormy Christmas Eve here in LA. And also, I want you to know I would not be here if it were not for people like Tucker, were not for people like Bhagwan Rajneesh, Swami Muktananda, Dr. Paul Masters, all of these teachers that lead us and guide us in ways. And definitely my Buddhist practice has really helped me to understand everything that I was taught prior to becoming a Buddhist. It helped me implement it. It helped me apply it. It helped me make it me. It helped me be the me I was trying to be. And we will see you next week. Tucker, you got anything else to say before we get out?
I sure do. Merry Christmas.
Ah! Merry, merry. I don't really do Christmas. I'm a very New Year's Day kind of person. But for all of those out you that do celebrate, Merry Christmas. And please, no tragedies. If you can help it, stay at home and drink. You know, don't go out and do drugs in your house, in the bedroom or somewhere. You know, because there's so much energy going on out there that are forces that don't want a whole world to move forward. You have to understand we're advancing into the future. There's a lot of kickback from the past that we're experiencing. A lot of kickback, you know, a lot of kickback. So just be safe, be well, and be happy. And I love you, and I love you, and I'll see you next week. Bye, Tucker. Thank you so much. I love you. Bye. Bye.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.